What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Mark Latham.
Independent MP Mark Latham joins me this afternoon. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Brent. Powering through the last day of Parliament here in Macquarie Street and hoping to get through to Christmas, of course. So, yeah, we're coming to a year's end.
So what does that mean? I suppose busy, 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 or does it start to slow down? Because is today the very last day for sitting for 2023?
It's the last scheduled day, but it could run into Friday morning or even be adjourned to come back during the Friday daytime for longer sitting. What does it mean in practice? Well, both sides of politics, the old government and the new one, have a bad habit of back-end loading legislation. There's, well, seven or eight bills, three or four of them contentious on the agenda today in the upper house, whereas, you know, earlier in the year we're going home at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday instead of sitting through and legislating. So they back-end load these things, saying that they're urgent, that they couldn't be scheduled earlier. But I think what they try to do is stampede the Parliament into passing them so people can go home and finish the year. So it's not very good legislative practice. We do try to scrutinise these things, and if it means sitting to 3 or 4 o'clock on Friday morning or coming back tomorrow, that's what we're determined to do.
Was it a late sitting, early morning sitting yesterday?
Yesterday it went through to the normal time. Tuesday they went through to midnight.
Oh, okay.
To finalise the net zero bill and consider 50-odd amendments. So it was Tuesday night, went through 12:30, the Parliament finished after the adjournment debate.
So this was, it says, I've got an article here in front of me, Mark, and it says an alliance of New South Wales crossbenchers have successfully secured a significant number of amendments to ensure the state's climate laws are more than ornamental. Tell us more about this.
Well, they're ornamental, no matter the targets they put in there, because they are just targets, and there's no punishment or sanction on the government if the targets aren't met. So they're trying to go to net zero, 50% by 2030, 70% by 2035, and net zero 2050. But they're only targets that the previous government had, and the real substance of the bill is to set up a net zero commission, which will provide advice to government, and there's a lot of advice that's needed. How much does net zero cost? What's the budgetary impact? What could it possibly achieve in terms of global climate? Not a lot, if anything. And how do we resolve all these land use issues where the farming community in particular doesn't like the idea of losing prime agricultural land because of big transmission corridors and all the land use of solar farms and wind farms? So there's a lot of issues out there. Net zero, unfortunately, is sort of a hope, an aspiration that the left-wing people have, but they've done basically no research, Brent, in terms of what it means in practice. And this new commission is there to fill in the gaps. I had an amendment successfully moved that they should give strong regard to equity and social justice issues, looking after disadvantaged groups and, you know, low-income earners, of course. People who rent, can't afford the insulation and sometimes go without heating in the winter, they're the ones who will suffer if the energy bills continue to rise.
You said no research in practice. I was going to say to you, can I say there's probably not a lot of research done either in reference to how much all of these wish lists are going to cost the general public?
Yeah, it's a hope, it's an aspiration, all this net zero stuff. The one report that I relied on, remarkably no one in the government had read it, was a very credible report by Professor Batterham using modelling from Melbourne, Queensland and Princeton universities that pointed out two very important things. One, that going to net zero in Australia will cost $18 trillion. I mean, just absorb that. $18 trillion, which is 12 times our national output, our GDP. And he raised the prospect there might not be enough available land to accommodate the solar farms, the wind farms, and the transmission wires that use a hell of a lot of land. Because once you take away residential land, industrial land, inaccessible land, ecosystem land, national parks, indigenous land, and privately owned land, there's not a lot left. So it's very, very difficult to know where it's all going to end because nobody is projected forward to say, how much land do you need? How much money do you need? And most importantly, will this make any difference to the world's climate? No, it won't.
That's the sad part. It won't make a great deal of difference to the world climate at all. Anyway,
well, it's bizarre. Like, it's the most bizarre thing I've seen in my parliamentary life. There's no one in the government can say how much it costs, what it will achieve, or how much land it will use. Now, what do they do all day, these people? They've got a whole army of bureaucrats. They talk till they're blue in the face about climate change and net zero. Where's the research? Where's the evidence?
The future of racing in New South Wales has come down to a band of cross benches when legislation to extend the term of the body's chairman, Russell Balding, is debated in Parliament's upper house. Have they done this debating yet, or is it still to come?
It's been through the lower house and will come to us later this afternoon.
Right.
It's not really about Russell Balding, who's fairly anonymous. He's the chair of Racing New South Wales. He's been there 12 years, a long, long time appointment, isn't it? And they're trying to give him 14 years.
Right.
I always say, if you haven't got it done in 12 years, you won't get it done.
14.
You know, 12 years are long, long enough. But it's really about Peter Volandis. Peter Volandis, who runs racing and rugby league in New South Wales, is probably the most powerful person in the state, other than Albanese and Chris Minns.
Right.
Peter Volandis got into the White House dinner with Joe Biden.
He did, didn't
recently.
He?
So he's a powerful guy. He's nice to talk to, and he's pulled all the right reins in terms of power plays to elevate himself. But is it healthy for an organisation essentially to be run by one person and exercise all that power, or would it be healthy to have a new chair, younger, energetic, new ideas, challenging some of the areas where the Volandis critics say that there are shortcomings? So I think for the health of Racing New South Wales, I'm a great racing fan and supporter myself, but I think it's healthy in any organisation to have a little bit of a contest of ideas about the direction in which the organisation is headed. You just don't want one person to rubber stamp everything, because inevitably that ends up with major problems that are never corrected.
Peter and I go back a long way. We went to Kira Boys High School together in Wollongong. Right. He used to sit next to me in physics.
Wow, what a small world. How about that, eh?
There you go.
Well, yeah. I don't know, he went in physics, but he's done all right in rugby league.
He has done all right in rugby league, hasn't he? Yeah. And actually, he was a good student. That? He was a good student. Well, he was well-behaved and never got into trouble.
Is that right? Okay.
Yep.
Oh, well, he's in the building today. I saw him down in the foyer, and he had two policemen next to him, so I don't know if he's in trouble. I joked. I said, if you're in here lobbying and you need an arm protection, well, you're obviously doing it tough.
This is something that I came across today. Are you surprised at this? Chris Bowen's on his way to, what is it, COP28. Apparently, he's taking 48 Australian government bureaucrats with him. Oh. That's ministerial staff, officials, all that sort of stuff. And they fly to Dubai tomorrow. So he's just not going on his own. He's taking 48 other Australian officials with him.
Yeah, burning all that airline fuel, adding to carbon emissions. You know, there'll be hundreds of private jets and government jets flying into Dubai International Airport, supposedly to save the planet. It's quite the contradiction, isn't it? It's a bit ironic that they're having this UN climate change conference in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, in Dubai, where they've made all their money getting oil out of the ground and exporting it for people to burn it and supposedly cause the climate change problem. So I understand that in Dubai, their big initiative will be electric vehicle taxis. Not too sure that's going to make up for all the oil they've got out of the ground over the years. So it's a strange place to have a climate change conference. And, of course, they'll all jet in there and enjoy the tourism much more than solving any problems.
The OECD, their latest economic outlook released overnight, laid out an assumed timeline for interest rate relief while predicting growth would slow further and unemployment would start to rise.
Well, it's welcome advice in terms of the interest rate problems here in Australia, because we do have a housing affordability crisis. There's a lack of housing supply in the major cities, particularly Sydney, but 12 interest rate rises in a row have obviously been very hurtful. So for the OECD to step in, their president is Matthias Cormann, who was the finance minister here for many years, of course, in the Liberal Party government. So the OECD advice is welcome, and hopefully the Reserve Bank listens to it, because inflation is moderating, the interest rate rises have done enough damage already, and it is time to give the home buyers a break.
Well, your thoughts on Michelle Bullock? I mean, she's now the new leader of, head of the RBA, and she was at a speaking event this week in Hong Kong. And what did she say? She was saying about these 13 interest rate rises, and despite the noise, she said households and businesses in Australia are actually in a pretty good position. Their balance sheets are pretty good. Mark, this reeks of just being out of touch completely.
Well, it's a long pattern. Under Philip Lowe at the Reserve Bank, they were out of touch. They got in too late to try and nip inflation in the bud. And that's why we've had so many interest rate rises. I'd lost count. I thought it was 12. It is 13. But to say that the balance sheet of the average Australian home is in good shape just completely defies the cost of living crisis that's very evident out there.
There was, I'm just trying to find it if I can, on the information that I've got. There was a survey out yesterday. Was it yesterday? Saying nearly half of all adults are experiencing some form of financial difficulty, with hardship levels reaching a record high. Hardship has now risen from a survey low of 29% in the first quarter of 2022. It's now trending at 37% in this survey. The results came out yesterday. That particular survey result there flies in the face of what Michelle Rowland has been saying on the world stage in Hong Kong.
Yeah, Michelle Bullock, head of the Reserve Bank, is probably on close to $1 million a year, so I'm sure she's not feeling a cost of living crisis. But if you get out there in the suburbs, not long ago, I was in the Liverpool suburb of Green Valley in southwest Sydney, and there was a charity shop, hundreds of people lining up outside the door, just trying to get some free clothes, a bit of free food. You know, these are proud local people who are only doing this out of desperation and absolute need. So it's not the prosperous Australia that you'll see on the North Shore of Sydney or the eastern suburbs or the Reserve Bank executives, but out there, there's some working people, people on a low income who are doing it exceptionally tough. And I know Green Valley quite well. I grew up there. And to see hundreds of people lined up outside a little shop there in Sadler was startling to me, and just rammed home how significant the cost of living crisis is when you get out there on the ground.
And the bells have stopped, Mark?
Yeah, they have. They're warning bells to give you 15 minutes notice. They'll start up again at 3 to 2.
Okay.
So the bells can drive you mad here. It's a bit of an asylum.
Let's be out by then. COVID numbers are up. New South Wales saw 1,352 COVID-19 cases. What is it? That's its fortnightly report. That was up 94% since October. Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia, the ACT and Tasmania, all their numbers are going up as well. I saw something yesterday from Singapore, and they were looking at last week 2,000 people in Singapore in a week coming down with this new strain of COVID-19, Mark.
Well, it's out there, and some of the media hysteria is cranked up again. Norman Swan, the so-called health expert at the ABC, saying put the masks back on. But I think the general public have probably reached the conclusion, look, we know enough about COVID. We know enough about our own personal health circumstances. The vaccines weren't effective in stopping the spread. Everyone's just going to cope their own way. Now, obviously, the old and the already sick need to take extra precautions. But if you're younger and healthier, there's been no record of those sorts of people dying with COVID. So the latest outbreak in these numbers, which are greater than, you know, when we had the big lockdowns around New South Wales, I don't think it's cause for panic. It's cause for treating people as adults and letting them get on with their own life their own way. I know here in New South Wales Parliament, Chris Minns, you know, the head of government, got COVID, not here this week. But there was a sort of press gallery drinks thing last night, everyone jammed in one room. There's no big outbreak here and no talk of super spreaders and all this sort of thing. So, Brent, I think it's just time for people to recognise that COVID will be around for a while, but everyone just cope their own way.
Speaking of COVID, Dominic Perrottet admits he made mistakes in reference to COVID management. He didn't have a lot to do, though, with COVID management, did he? Wasn't that all sort of done by his predecessor, Gladys Berejiklian, by the time he became the Premier?
A lot of it, but he was on the crisis cabinet and was a dissenting voice against a lot of the draconian rules, the lockdowns, the restrictions, the vaccine mandates. So Perrottet, I think, lost about 30 or 40 votes in a row on that little committee that ran the policy. So he was the treasurer and the deputy Liberal leader on that committee. So he saw all the data, he saw all the decision making. Then he became the Premier at the tail end of the COVID period. So he knows a lot about it, and he's saying policy mistakes were made. The evidence and the health advice didn't keep up with the changing environment, the changing evidence, and he's going to put in a detailed submission to this inquiry in Canberra that Albanese ordered. So that'll be fascinating when Perrottet puts all that data on the table, and I think it will meet the suspicion that a lot of people had that the evidence was changing, but the government was too proud or too reluctant to actually ease the restrictions a lot quicker than they should have.
Look, it's back in court, the Lerman-Higgins situation. I see that the latest update that I've got here, she has said today that the $216,000 promised to her if she wrote a book on the alleged sexual assault in Parliament would be donated to charity if it was ever finished. That was part of her evidence giving in the federal court today. She's also denied her claims around the alleged rape by Bruce Lerman had been adapted and evolved over time. He didn't do himself any justice earlier this week. I mean, he was caught lying on several occasions. He had to admit that he was lying. Maybe he's regretting the current legal action.
He might be. His evidence, you know, having a brain freeze and needing a 15-minute adjournment to gather his thoughts wasn't compelling. But you'd say the same about Brittany Higgins. And, you know, everyone's followed this case and heard about it, Brent. But you'd have to say now, aren't we at the point in the soap opera where there are two young people, two young lives that probably are being severely damaged by having to go through these processes. Court cases, now the defamation case, and I'm feeling sorry for both the young people. Now, we'll never really know the truth of what happened, but under the pressure of court cross-examination, neither Lerman or Higgins have sort of had a consistent story, consistent with their prior evidence and police reports and so forth. So, yeah, it's getting messier, more of a soap opera. And I think we'll look back and think, geez, those two young people, whatever happened, they should have dropped it all and got on with their lives after the court cases were abandoned.
The Sydney Theatre Company has apologised for its handling of this controversial curtain call this week. Tell us more about this, Mark.
Well, the actors in the play, and the Sydney Theatre Company is quite a big deal, the premier theatre organisation in Sydney, the actors decided to put on the Palestinian, the red and white headscarf. Nothing to do with the play, but as an act of solidarity with Palestine. Well, it upset the Jewish community, the Jewish audience members, Jewish patrons and financial supporters of the Sydney Theatre Company, and performance was then abandoned because the company lost control of what the actors wanted to do. And I think it just reinforces, whether we're talking about convoys or street marches or protests down at the Opera House, Brent, it reinforces the point. This is a conflict on the other side of the world between Israel and the Palestinians. Australians, we're lucky to live in this country. You're here, you've won the lottery of life. You don't have to make political statements at things like a theatre production. Can we get on with our good Australian way of life and leave the problems of the Middle East to the Middle East and the big nations like the United States and UK and the like? It's not Australia's responsibility. It's certainly not the responsibility of a bunch of actors to turn a play into a political event for something that's got nothing to do with Australia.
But haven't they cancelled tonight's performances
or
something?
Yeah. It's that bad that the performances aren't going ahead because the theatre company has lost control of what they've told them don't wear these scarves, and the actors obviously said, well, we're going to, so they've cancelled the whole thing. And they'd obviously be losing financial support from Jewish donors. So, you know, what sort of madness is this? So why can't people just stick to the good things about Australia and understand that some of these political protests for things happening in the Middle East are totally counterproductive in our country?
I agree. All right, I better let you go before the bells start ringing.
Back to the asylum.
Back
last
to the
day
asylum.
Of the year. Thanks, Brent.
All right, mate. We'll catch up with you next week.
Cheers.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Bye-bye. Independent MP Mark Latham, back to the asylum. The bells will ring. The bells will toll. They have to go back on the last day of sitting for Parliament in New South Wales, certainly.